Thanks, Mike. Like Mike said, fertilizer prices spiked, and I see my job today as to try to give some explanation and understanding of what drives fertilizer prices, why fertilizer prices increased over the past couple of years, and what we might expect in the future. So with that, just the first slide here, particularly if you look at the fertilizer numbers, illustrates the input cost for fertilizer for corn production over the past 3 years. These are USDA average numbers. They're actually kind of low. If you just looked at the states, say the I states, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, these numbers would be considerably higher. I actually did some calculations last winter where in 2009, just for corn alone, applying maintenance rates for 50 bushel soybeans, you'd need about your fertilizer cost would be about $300 per acre. If you fertilize like they often do in the Midwest, where they fertilize for both corn and beans in one crop, that figure would be closer to $400. So these are low numbers, so to speak. But the point is that I want to make is that you can see that between 2007 and 2008, fertilizer prices jumped significantly. And then again in 2009, fertilizer prices increased again. And like Mike said, the reason for this symposium is when the fertilizer prices spiked in between 2007 and 2008, we didn't see a great reduction in fertilizer use simply because commodity prices went right along with the increase in fertilizer prices. So farmers pretty much kept their standard programs. The following year, however, fertilizer prices increased and the commodity did not increase along with them, and that's when we had a fairly significant reduction in fertilizer use, which we'll talk about through this presentation. To really understand fertilizer supply and demand, you have to look at the world stage, because fertilizer is a worldwide traded commodity, and the drivers of supply and demand are really based on world factors. So if you look at what's happened over the past several years, you can see here that world population growth is actually approximately 75 million people per year. And with this growth, we have strong economies as well, particularly in India and China and some of the other developing countries. So we've had a shift. Because as these countries grow, they demand more food, but also there's a tremendous increase in the number of people who are moving into the middle classes in these countries. And the first thing that happens when people move into the middle classes, they change their diet from primarily a grain diet to a meat and vegetable diet. So you can see here that if we look at the grains and oilseed, meat consumption, fruit and vegetable consumption, that they've been increasing two or three times over the past 40 years. So quite an increase in global food consumption. If you look at what happened in 2008, I mentioned that commodity prices were high, and it had very little, then the fertilizer prices didn't have as much of an effect on what farmers were willing to pay for fertilizer. It was not just a U.S. phenomena. If you look at commodity prices around the world, here we're looking at rice, coffee, sugar, bananas, cocoa, palm oil, rubber, all of them have pretty much maintained their profitability, particularly over the 10-year average. So farmers around the world had an incentive to produce more food. They were getting paid well for it. There was a market for it. And that is really pushing the demand for fertilizers on the world scene. If we focus in on just the grain and oil seed production. Approximately 60% of the world's fertilizer is consumed by grains and oil seeds. Production in the Asian markets has increased primarily to meet rising domestic demand. Brazil and the U.S., the two largest grain producing countries, are increasing production more for the export market. If we look at fruit and vegetable productions over the past four decades, that has increased actually more than consumption. It's quadrupled. And there actually it's increased fivefold. And China actually accounts for most of this growth. And for those of you that work with fruit and vegetable growers, you know that generally the high cost of production is very high in these crops. Fertilizer costs relative to other costs are small, so they spare nothing on fertilizer. So fertilizer prices really don't have a major effect on how the fruits and vegetables get fertilized. And if you look at, and I'll show you a chart later just on potash, but 17% of the world's fertilizer actually goes on fruits and vegetables. And that's larger than any single crop per se. So it's a big market worldwide. And it's actually one of the drivers in the fertilizer supply and demand in the world markets. Biofuels is another one. We tend to think of biofuels as a U.S.-Brazil thing. Other countries around the world are actively pursuing biofuel development, and that is also driving fertilizer demand around the world. So if we look at the results of increasing population growth, increasing standard of living in the developing world, we see a few things that are fairly obvious when you think about it. We've got an increased food demand, increased commodity prices, more profitable. We're increasing our food production per se. We're increasing our resource demand for land and water for agricultural purposes. We're increasing the need for higher productivity. And along with that comes increased fertilization, more balanced fertilization in a lot of countries. And that all ties back to increased fertilizer use, which again is one of the real drivers in terms of the supply and demand and the price that fertilizers command on the world market. Now, if we just spend just a minute talking about fertilizer demand on the world scale, this graph shows the percentage of total global fertilizer consumption used by selected countries. And I think there's nine up here. And we have China, India, European Union, Brazil, which is European Union is obviously more than one, Pakistan, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Canada. These countries, and you can see there's a very fast drop-off after Brazil, so we have really five major consumers of fertilizer. But these nine countries up here represent 75% of the total NPK fertilizer use in the world. So it's a small number of people in the market, but it's still a very, very competitive market. The developing countries like China, India, and Pakistan are a little slower on potash use than the others, and they're going to pick that up as they go more toward a balanced fertilizer program, and we'll talk more about that later. But first I wanted to just cover these nutrients one by one, talking about nitrogen and giving an overview of nitrogen. And here you can see that nitrogen is produced on every continent in the world in 60 different countries. So really, when we look at the international nitrogen market, a lot of the nitrogen is sourced locally, what we consider locally. There is a lot of trade, particularly in urea from around the world, but there's a lot of local production as well. Nitrogen production facilities are usually located where there are natural gas reserves. China uses natural gas as well as coal. They're kind of an exception in using coal for urea production. But the major concern with nitrogen production in the future is going to be, and the production capacity, is whether capacity is going to keep up with demand. It's not really an issue of resources per se. It's a more of an issue of, are we going to have the plants in place to produce nitrogen products to keep up with world demand, because world demand for nitrogen products is increasing. China is kind of a wild card in all of this. They are the world's largest producer, but they tend to export when the export prices are good. If there's a tight market, they levy very high export taxes on their producers to discourage them from exporting into the market, and they create shortages in the world market because they're in and out of the markets. And that happened a couple of years ago, really drove nitrogen prices up because China really pulled out of the export market. If we look at the costs of nitrogen production, I mentioned that nitrogen production generally occurs where you have natural gas. It's not just having natural gas, it's having relatively cheap natural gas, because natural gas currently makes up about 90% of the cost of producing anhydrous ammonia in the U.S. and in other parts of the world. It's nearing that same number. If we look at was this up when I was talking about that? This is just a demonstration of the conversion costs are fairly constant across a wide range of gas prices. So the cost of anhydrous ammonia is really very, very closely related to the price of gas. The countries around the world that produce and export most of the anhydrous ammonia are Trinidad, North Africa, the Middle East, and Australia. They're the low-cost export regions, and they supply about 9 million tons of anhydrous into the international market. Western Europe, Western Europe is a high-cost producer, and they're at a disadvantage because of high natural gas costs. Russia and the Ukraine are also at a disadvantage because their gas costs have gone up the past couple of years as well. What's happened over the past couple of years is as natural gas prices have gone up, and because of the world economy, there's been not only a reduction in demand for anhydrous ammonia in agriculture, but we use a lot of anhydrous ammonia in industry as well. We use it for making fabrics. We use it in nitrogen in phosphate manufacturing. We use it in acid production, things like that. So there's a kind of a competition for anhydrous ammonia on the world outside of agriculture as well. With the downturn in the economies, some of these countries and companies are really having to curtail nitrogen production. They can make it, and they just really don't have markets to take it into. If we look at the ability to keep up with growth in demand for nitrogen on a world basis, you can see this, the blue line is the import growth. And you can see here that in the Middle East, Africa, we are very, very dependent upon new ammonia capacity coming on in Egypt in particular to keep up with expected growth in the market. If these plants don't come on, we could have maybe not a shortage in nitrogen, but certainly it would affect the prices. So the world economy right now has actually got a major effect on our industry as a whole. If we change and look at urea as opposed to ammonia, the same thing can be shown here with the trend lines. The world urea capacity additions and demand growth outside of China are really expected to be relatively tight over the next 4 to 5 decades, particularly if we include China in this picture. We're going to have a very, very hard time keeping up with the production costs and the amount of material that's needed. If we look at, let me back up and talk about imports. The countries that import urea, that are the big players and are setting the price for urea, are India and the United States. We import a lot of urea. India's a little bigger than us. Growth in urea imports in the future are going to be driving to some degree the urea market. And when the prices started to go up in 2008 and then in 2009, demand for urea softened, and so a lot of global capacity for urea production was taken offline. And that is happening today as we speak. There's a lot of urea capacity that is being taken offline because there's just not a market for it in agriculture or in other segments of our economies. If we look at, just as a point here in the U.S., to demonstrate what happened with urea for the 2009 crop year, 2008-2009 crop year, in 2007-08, urea shipments had reached 18.5 million tons. In 2009, we basically had a 10% decrease in the amount of urea going into the U.S. market. And again, the demand for industrial nitrogen impacted the costs of urea and the plants that were closed and as a result of, or not closed, but production was curtailed because there just wasn't the demand for urea in the market. For phosphate, we'll go through this as quickly as I can. The producers, there's really the five top phosphate rock producing countries account for about 80% of total production, and China is by far the largest phosphate producer. The U.S. is the second largest, and but again, because of lack of demand and to some degree a lower quality ore, we've actually reduced our phosphate production by about 10 million tons, or 28%, just in the last 10 years. Global supply of rock is okay. It's just a matter of the quality of the rock in some cases. If we look at the cost of production of DAP, you really need to be an integrated producer to make money in the phosphate industry, and that means you have to have the ore, you have to have the source of sulfuric acid, you have to have a source of anhydrous ammonia to make phosphate nitrogen products like DAP and MAP and ammonium polyphosphate. If you don't have these, you're really at a disadvantage, and countries like India are at a disadvantage because they are not integrated producers. They bring everything in and make material on site. The phosphate capacity around the world is growing. When fertilizer prices get high, countries think it's a good deal to get into it. So we actually have increase in phosphoric acid production capacity, and you can see here that we're going to need every bit of it to keep up with anticipated demand in the future. Where's it going? It's going to India. India is by far and away the largest importer of phosphate products. Okay, we're going to go to potash now. Do a quick overview on potash. Significant amount of potash is produced only in about 12 countries around the world, and really by about five major companies. 80% of the potash is traded across borders, with Canada and the Soviet Union as the major producers. If you look at where it's used by different crops, again, fruits and vegetables are the single largest crop required that potash is going to, but your grain crops are also very, very significant. If you look at potash fertilizer consumption, it's, you know, we started off talking about where the fertilizer was consumed around the world. The same countries keep popping up: China, India, Southeast Asia, and Brazil, as well as United States. And you can see that over time these markets have grown consistently. If you look at what the future for potash is, countries like India and China that have imbalances in their fertility programs are using much more nitrogen than they should be using relative to phosphorus and potassium. You can see here that there's tremendous growth potential for using more potash in those countries, and that will actually have a dramatic effect on potash prices in the future, because the limited number of places where potash is produced around the world. In the U.S. last year, we had a dramatic drop off in potash use, as much as 40%. We're not sure how the numbers are going to settle out, again, largely related to prices. And part of this seminar today is really talking about some of the consequences of these cutbacks, not just in terms of production and how we go about it, but what are the long-term consequences for soil tests and things like that. As a result of the drop-off, a lot of the potash companies have curtailed production. Just in North America alone, we've curtailed over 10 million tons of potash production, and worldwide closer to 12 million. So rather than mine potash and sell it into, or try to force it into the market, we're just not doing it. The other thing that's significant about the potash market is I just wanted to point out here that we do expect shipments to pick up again in 2010. One of the things about the potash market is it's fairly easy to get into nitrogen and phosphate production compared to potash production. Potash production is a very complex picture. And there has not been a new potash mine built in North America in the last 40 years, and there's only been one built in the world in the last 30 years. So what we're working with is existing mines. If you look at the what the potash industry is doing, is they are expanding production at existing mines. They're not building new mines. We get a lot of questions about the long-term picture of fertilizers. And as terms of nitrogen, it's really not a natural resources issue. Its supply is going to be tied to cost of natural gas. For rock phosphate, there's plentiful reserves around the country. But like a lot of things, if prices are low, some of those reserves aren't worth mining and processing. As prices get higher, some of those reserves look very attractive. So rock quality, prices of phosphate fertilizers will really dictate long-term availability. We use a lot of sulfur in phosphate fertilizer production. That will have an effect as well. And then for your DAP MAPs and ammonium polyphosphates, nitrogen prices will have an effect. In terms of potash, and here I'm specifically referring to KCL, potash prices are really going to be dictated by future expansions of existing mines, and probably not very much, if any, by development of new mines. So we really expect this year that fertilizer prices will probably be closer to the 2007 crop year. Prices are down on all fertilizers compared to last year. They may not be quite the level we were at 2006, but certainly lower than 2009 and 2008. So with that, thank you, Mike.